Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back for another episode in my mystery series, where today we have a historic mystery to explore. You've definitely all heard of Jack the Ripper, right? Prowling the streets of Whitechapel in London for victims throughout 1888. But have you heard of the Thames Torso Murderer, another serial killer roaming the streets of London at the same time from 1887 to 1889? Sometimes referred to as the Thames Mysteries or the Embankment Murders. Could they have been the same person? Maybe, but probably not according to the Metropolitan Police at the time. Just like Jack, the Thames Torso Murderer did take pleasure in taunting the police, and they were just as precise as you'll come to see, but the murders weren't actually all that similar, and it's not out of the realms of possibility that there were two active serial killers in London at this time. In fact, considering the state of the city at this point, it's surprising to me there weren't more serial killers, more people who just cracked. I do feel like I need to give a warning before I get into this case. Although I've tried to keep it as gentle as possible, this one is undeniably graphic. If you are of a sensitive disposition, this one might not be the video for you. You see, London at this time in history was bleak. It was this mixture of startling contrasts. On one hand, you had the London that was affluent, new, elaborate buildings popping up on every corner. Thanks to the Industrial Revolution, certain businesses were booming. New docks were being built to increase the city's trade. More money was coming into the city than ever before. But the population had also increased exponentially, with a population of around 1 million people in 1800 growing to 6.5 million by the 1900s. That's a lot of new people coming into a city that didn't quite have the infrastructure to cope with it, which led to unimaginable squalor and filth for those who didn't have money. The richest of society and the poorest of society lived side by side in London. Raw sewage flowed into the street, chimneys threw out thick smoke. Horses were literally doing their business in the streets, and most people didn't have the facilities to be able to wash. London was disgusting. You had people living in overcrowded slums, a lot of people not having a static address to live at all, men, women and children. Doss houses, which was the colloquial name for lodging houses at the time, of which there are about 1,000 in London, would rent out beds by the night, the bedding unchanged for God knows how long. If you were having a rough time, you could pay for a 4-penny coffin, in which you could lay down, and they were exactly what the name suggests, wooden boxes that looked a lot like coffins. For even less than that, you could pay for a rope bed, in which you could literally just slump yourself across a rope and attempt to sleep. That's a true story. For a lot of people, the goal in London every day was simply to raise enough money to pay for a bed that night. I share all of this to illustrate the point that if you were poor in London at this time, life sucked. I mean, maybe even so if you were rich, but I would imagine considerably less so. Is it surprising that killers roam the streets of London? Not at all. It was the perfect city to find victims. People were living off the grid, just working to survive day and night. People were exhausted. The first evidence of a Thames murderer showed up in the May of 1887, with the first of four canonical victims. There are a few other cases we'll explore towards the end of the video that may have been victims as well, but only four are considered to be in the official case files that belong to this series of murders. The first of the four is a case often referred to as the Raynham Mystery. It was just after dawn on Wednesday, 11th of May, 1887, when a man working on the river near Raynham in East London sees a bundle floating in the water. It's like a canvas sack and he pulls it onto his barge. Of course, the Thames was used as a dumping ground by pretty much everyone in London. It was just as disgusting as the streets above, so it was full of miscellaneous items. Taking the bundle onto the shore, he opens the sack and inside finds what is undeniably a female torso. The body had been dismembered, the arms, legs and head all gone, as well as a section of both breasts. The torso had been cut off just above the breast, meaning there was no neck, and high on the legs as well. Of course, a policeman was called and a number of officers were soon sent to search this area, but nothing more could be found in these immediate searches. But this made sense, as it was pretty obvious that the remains had originally been dumped further upstream and had just been found near Raynham. The torso was described as waterlogged, suggesting it had been in the water for quite some time. However, because the remains were found in Raynham, they were Raynham's responsibility, despite the fact that they didn't have a mortuary or a coroner, so the remains were simply placed in a shed to wait for the inquest, which would happen on the coming Saturday. The first witness at the inquest was a police surgeon called Dr. Edward Galloway, who said that the legs had been removed with a perfectly straight cut made with a very sharp saw. In fact, all of the cuts on the body had been made very cleanly, very sharply. There were no signs of hesitation or doubt. Interestingly, there was also no sign of external violence on the body, no other cuts or bruises. But without the extremities, there was no way of saying exactly how the victim died. Dr. Galloway did say he believed the victim had been dead for about 2 weeks, from probably around the beginning of May. She was 5'3" to 5'4" and she probably had brown hair, although how he was able to tell this is questionable, as she wouldn't have had any pubic or arm hair to glean this information from. She could have been anywhere from her late 20s to 35 years old, and she had never given birth. The state of the body led Galloway to believe that this was a murder victim and had not been used by hospital or university for dissection, as often happened. Regardless anyway, by this point the Anatomy Act of 1832 had been in place for a very long time, meaning that there were generally records kept of bodies used by doctors and medical students. If you want to learn more about that, you can watch my video on Burke and Hare. However, Galloway did say that the precision with which the cuts had been made, the very clear understanding of the human body, led him to believe that the murderer was a surgeon or a doctor. Because they couldn't find a cause of death, they did just record a verdict of found dead, which is something I'd never heard of before. Can you clarify it's murder if you don't know how they died? You probably can when all you've got is a torso, but I guess they couldn't completely rule out that she'd been dissected in a medical setting. Interestingly, this crime actually didn't make front page news at the time. Violent crimes like this were 10 a penny in London at this time. It was an isolated case and it wasn't all that interesting to the papers. I do wonder if they might have had more of a chance of identifying the woman though, if it did make front page news when it first happened. I just want to take a moment out here to talk about my main source for this video, a book I downloaded onto my Kindle called The Thames Torso Murders by MJ Trow. It's a really extensive account of the crimes, pretty much the only extensive account I could really find, and a really good read, so I would recommend if you really want a deep dive into this case, going to read it. And the rest of my sources will all be linked down below as well, in case you fancy a browse. But yeah, would highly recommend this book. Not long after the torso was found, at the beginning of June, more body parts started to turn up. This time it was found at a pier halfway between Blackfriars and Waterloo Bridges, a completely different part of London than Raynham. It's pretty much near where the Oxo Tower is now, for anyone who knows the city. At around 10 a.m, somebody reported seeing a large parcel in the water, which was soon fished out by a pierman. But it wasn't a parcel, it was a sack tied with cord, inside of which they found a human thigh. Later that very same day, another sack was found on the south bank near Battersea Park, in which they found the upper portion of a human body, the neck and the arms. At first, police didn't immediately connect these new body parts with the Raynham torso, but once Dr. Galloway examined all the parts, he concluded they all came from the same body, they fit together like puzzle pieces, and the same level of surgical skill was shown. Interestingly though, these newest body parts to be found had not been in the water for as long as the torso had been. The skin wasn't waterlogged or wrinkled. If they'd been placed in the water at the same time as the torso had been, they would have been in there for about a month. But no, they were fresh, like they'd only just been placed in there. Meaning that somebody was wandering around London with body parts in a bag, just throwing them into the river. A week later, the final body parts to be found for this victim would turn up in Regent's Canal, which actually wasn't a part of the main Thames River, it had to have been put in there, not in the river. Inside a sack, tied with cord as always, they found two human legs, and these had been in the water for quite some time, deduced from the wrinkling of the skin. Another piece of the Raynham torso puzzle. By the 21st of July, the Times were able to confirm that the entire body, except for the head and upper part of the chest, had now been found. In each case, except for very strangely the thigh, the exact same canvas had been used to wrap them. The police asked for people to come forward to report missing female family members, but no positive identifications ever came out of this, and the case eventually got closed. This was clearly just a one-off brutal murder. She had possibly been killed by someone close to her, hence why nobody ever came forward to claim the body. It was horrible, but it surely wouldn't happen again. But of course it would, with the second murder in this case often being referred to as the Whitehall Mystery, starting on the 11th of September 1888. The scene of this discovery is slightly further west down the river, very close to Parliament and Big Ben, and where Scotland Yard is now located. Something in that seems apt. It was actually in the construction process of Scotland Yard that this happened. By this time, September 1888, the Jack the Ripper murders had just begun a couple of weeks earlier, and London was abuzz with gossip about the deaths of Mary Ann Nichols and Annie Chapman, the latter of which had happened just 3 days earlier. Everyone was speculating who could be responsible for such horrific crimes, the nature of which was so disgusting that it just caught everyone's attention. The Ripper murders could not be ignored. When the arm of another woman was pulled out of the Thames on the 11th, the media just didn't quite have the capacity to cover both cases. Had Jack the Ripper not been active at the same time as the torso killer, might the torso killer have been more notorious? Possibly. But for whatever reason, people simply didn't care about the Thames torso killer as much. I put my research in, but I couldn't really find any solid reason as to why it didn't receive as much coverage. It likely was because of the Ripper's taunting of the authorities, but by this point no letters had been received from Jack the Ripper. The torso murders were just more ignored. Whilst the torso killings were probably much more brutal with the dismemberment of the bodies, the Ripper killings were more gory with the disembowelment. Perhaps it was deemed that the latter was more appealing to newspaper audiences. It is all about sales at the end of the day, isn't it? Capitalism, let's not forget that. The later Jack the Ripper letters would definitely contribute towards the coverage of the Ripper though. When this new body part of the torso killings were first found, police weren't all too worried, assuming that it may have been a prank from medical students. Perhaps they didn't want to admit that it was happening again. The arm was examined and measuring it led experts to say that it was a woman's arm, that she was Caucasian with a darker complexion and probably about 5'9" tall. It was said that the arm had been removed by somebody with knowledge of anatomy, particularly as it was found with string tied around the shoulder end of the arm, which they said was used as a ligature. But other than that, there were no clues, it was just an arm. It was just over 2 weeks later when more body parts were found by construction workers, at 6 a.m. on the 1st of October. This was in the same area, the same construction site, the beginnings of what we now know as Scotland Yard, and workers would often hide their very heavy tools in and around the construction site, so they didn't have to carry them to and from work every day. On the 1st of October, a worker reached behind a set of boards to retrieve his tools, and he felt something, a parcel, didn't really think anything of it, and just got on with his work for the day. The next day he noticed though that the parcel was still there and eventually his curiosity got the best of him and his colleagues. The foreman ordered that this parcel should be opened. Inside was the torso of a woman, maggot infested, and the foreman went to the King Street Police Station to report it that very same afternoon. The subsequent autopsy showed the torso belonged to a female. The breast had not been cut off, unlike the Raynham torso though. The torso had been severed at the neck and above the pelvis, and she had no visible marks or scars, but she was a brunette as seen by her armpit hair. The cuts were clean and her organs were in good condition, suggesting that she was lucky enough not to be affected by the heavy pollution and the numerous respiratory diseases common in London at the time. They believed that the woman had died about 2 months beforehand. The police got to work trying to identify the woman, the entire unit of 935 men on the ground combing the area, checking local buildings, knocking on doors, finding out what they could. They brought in bloodhounds to search for the remaining body parts, but there was no luck. There was a small lead when a newspaper called the Illustrated Police News, that was actually just a scandal sheet with no actual connection to the police, said that a man had been nearby the dump site on the 29th of September when he saw three men with a wheelbarrow containing a bundle. Now, we all know the torso wasn't there before the 29th, as the worker said that it wasn't there when he was getting his tools. So he wouldn't become aware of this bulky package until the 1st. Now, this was reported to the police at the time, who followed up and spoke to a workman who admitted that it was him with the wheelbarrow and the bundle. But it wasn't the torso, he said, and the lead never went any further than that. Although there is actually no record of this conversation taking place. It is believed, though, that only somebody who knew this construction site well would be familiar with this hiding spot. Even the worker who hid his tools there had to access it with a match in hand because it was so dark. Not to mention the fact that the construction site was locked and shouldn't have been able to be accessed by anyone. Although, of course, it would have been fairly easy to pick the lock, I'm sure. Interestingly, I mentioned earlier that it was Jack the Ripper's taunting of the police that sealed him a place in the papers and in history. But a strange letter was also received by the police in the torso case as well, a letter forwarded to the chief constable, starting, "Dear friend, in the name of God, hear me. I swear I did not kill the female whose body was found at Whitehall. If she was an honest woman, I will hunt her down and destroy her murderer. If she was a whore, God will bless the hand that slew her," before the writer going on to a whole load of very dark ramblings. Was this written by the killer? Was it written by a madman? Was it written by somebody who wanted attention? We don't really know. Like, don't get me wrong, light coverage of the torso murders did reach the papers. It wasn't just completely ignored, but it certainly never reached the same notoriety of Jack the Ripper. And this case needed more notoriety. It needed people to be identified. After no more body parts turned up in the immediate search of the construction site and the water near it, it was assumed that they either weren't going to turn up or would eventually just wash up further downstream. But on the 17th of October, a journalist was allowed into the site with his dog, and his dog immediately started digging before pulling out an entire left leg from the earth, complete with foot. This was literally all it took. The limb was taken to the local mortuary and the dog was taken back to the site again, upon which he straightaway found a missing left arm as well, which was directly underneath where the left leg had been buried. It was found that the arm and leg had definitely been there for quite a while, longer than the torso had been as well, which suggested that whoever placed them here had entered the site not just once, but twice. But also burying these limbs would have taken much more labour than just stashing a parcel or throwing a parcel into the river. Whoever did this was clearly quite happy to take their time to maybe play a game with investigators. This victim was also sadly never identified. Then things went quiet for a few months until the 4th of June 1889, when rumours started to spread that more remains had been found. Some young boys in Bermondsey had noticed a strange object along the shoreline and decided to throw rocks at it. I wouldn't expect anything else from young boys. A local noticed what was going on and went to have a look. After investigating, they found that the strange object was a parcel containing human remains, although sources differ as to what exactly was inside the parcel. Luckily, a policeman was on patrol nearby, picked up the parcel and took it to the local station. Around this same time, about half a mile away, a man was bathing in the water near Albert Bridge and saw a parcel. He got hold of it and took it to the police, who discovered it contained a human thigh. There was something different about this case though. The thigh had been wrapped in clothing, a lady's overcoat and underwear, and pieces of this underwear had also been found in the other parcel as well, linking these two sets of remains. The underwear just so happened to have a name written on the waistband, L.E. Fisher. Now, there's not many situations in which a person would feel the need to label their underwear, and authorities immediately knew that she must have been living in some kind of shared situation. So they go to explore local boarding houses to see if anyone had any helpful information, but it would be quite a while before they had any answers. Over the coming weeks, more remains would be found across London. On the 6th of June, a gardener at Battersea Park found a parcel laying on the ground near some shrubbery, and this wasn't too far from the shoreline of the river. This would turn out to be the upper part of a woman's torso, the chest cavity empty. That same afternoon, a man working on a barge at Covington's Wharf also found a parcel, which was wrapped with portions of a dark-coloured skirt, which again allowed them to link it to the remains found a couple of days beforehand. With each new discovery, doctors were able to piece together a description of this woman using measurements they took from the body parts. More discoveries will come over the coming days. On the 15th of June, the inquest into this murder was opened, and it was publicly announced the woman was 7 to 8 months pregnant at the time of her death. The unborn child had been removed via an incision into the uterus after the woman had died. It was also assumed the fetus had died. It was first thought that the death came as a result of an illegal abortion, but that thought was soon dismissed. There was no cause of death established because vital body parts never turned up. No head, throat, lungs or heart. They even employed the dog who'd found the previous body parts at Scotland Yard to come and help in the search for this one, for the head, to no avail. At this inquest, it was stated that the mutilation of the body had showed skill and design, but it was no longer thought that the perpetrator was a surgeon. Instead, it was suggested that he could have been a butcher. The technical skills were similar to cutting up an animal. The similarities to the previous two murders were noted at the inquest, but at this point in history, the term serial killer was almost 100 years off, so it wasn't confirmed they were all connected. The potential involvement of Jack the Ripper was also thrown around, and the police did receive a couple of letters that referenced Jack being the killer, letters signed off in his name, but it was thought that it was probably just the work of a copycat letter writer, somebody who was just bored. Towards the end of June, newspapers started to report that the victim had been identified. Police had been looking for her identity for quite a while now, and they had a lot to go on. They had potential initials, clothing, a vague physical description, the fact that she was pregnant, and a very noticeable scar on her wrist. The family of a local born and bred woman from Chelsea called Elizabeth Jackson had been expressing their concern after Elizabeth had gone missing at the end of May, and her father even said that he was worried she had become the latest Thames victim. Soon it was confirmed that his fears were reality. The unidentified victim was indeed Elizabeth Jackson. Not quite the L.E. Fisher named on the underwear, but they still found her identity, and it is possible that L.E. Fisher was just another name she went by. And having her identity meant the investigators were potentially able to get one step closer to her murderer, able to track down her movements in the days and hours before her death. As suspected, Elizabeth frequently stayed in lodging houses, despite having family nearby. She was destitute and was likely a sex worker to survive. The lodging houses she most often frequented were all within walking distance of where her lighter body parts had been found, so it was suspected that she had been killed and dismembered nearby. She was also thought to have picked up most of her clients in Battersea Park, where her torso had been found. Despite all this information, investigators never found themselves any closer to finding her perpetrator. The inquest was reopened to confirm Elizabeth's identity and to hear new testimony from people who knew her, and eventually it was concluded that her death was willful murder. The final canonical murder of this case would come a couple of months later in September 1889, over 2 years now since the first body parts had been found. It was the morning of the 10th when a local constable came across a mutilated torso underneath the railway arch in Pinchin Street. The torso was still partially dressed and the arms were found alongside, all starting to decompose. The murder had not been recent, it seemed. Rigor mortis had come and gone, and it was quickly thought that the victim had not been killed in this location due to a lack of blood at the scene. The medical examiner found that the woman had dark hair, she was around 5'3" and anywhere from 25 to 40 years old. It was thought that she might have died on the evening of the 8th of September, about 36 hours before she'd been found. She had extensive bruising on her back, hip and arm, which suggested that she had been severely beaten before her death, different from the other victims of the torso killer, where a bruise was rarely found. Her abdomen had also been mutilated, her organs hanging out, which was very reminiscent of the work of Jack the Ripper. However, her genitals hadn't been mutilated, another one of the Ripper's calling cards. By this point, the Ripper had gone quiet, not being heard of since the murder of Mary Jane Kelly in November 1988, so nearly a year before this. But the Pinchin Street murder did raise questions. It raised questions as to whether the Ripper was back. Was this a copycat? Was it another victim of the torso killer? The fact that it was the victim's torso found does suggest the latter. Investigators did their usual searching for an identity, but they didn't get lucky again this time, and to this day this victim remains unidentified. They did think it was one missing woman for a bit, but a few days later she turned up alive and kind of well in hospital. This victim's cause of death was never able to be determined, and eventually she was dismissed as a potential Ripper victim. As you can imagine, there was a lot of question at the time as to whether the Ripper and the Torso Killer were the same person. Some people do still think they were, but most Ripperologists, experts on the Ripper case, dispute this, saying that the MOs between the two perpetrators were way too different. Would a killer in Victorian London, before the study and knowledge of killers that we have today, really have had the foresight to commit two separate types of murders at the same time to avoid getting caught? Especially when the Ripper seemed much more disorganised and frantic than the Torso Killer, who clearly took his time. It's unlikely, not impossible, but most experts agree that they probably weren't the same person. The biggest overlap did come in the form of the Pinchin Street torso though, which had enough similarities to raise these questions. Could it have been that the Torso Killer felt inspired by stories of the Ripper? Other than speculation, that's all we have in the case of the Thames Torso Killer. Once again, in the case of the Pinchin Torso, it was speculated the murder was somebody more accustomed to cutting animals than humans, but it doesn't seem like investigators ever even got slightly close to apprehending him. If they had today's forensic tech, they probably would have been able to get a lot closer, but at the end of the day, they didn't. They had nothing to go on apart from good old detective work, and in Victorian England, a lot of people simply didn't want to speak to the police, especially the kind of people who would have known these victims personally. It's assumed that all of these women were sex workers, or at the very least poor, working in the streets just before to stay in the lodging houses each night. People living that kind of lifestyle are going to be a lot harder to track down, including the people who socialise with them. Any search for the perpetrator was always going to be futile. We were probably looking for a butcher of some description, most likely a man due to the brute strength required to dismember bodies like this, but that's all they had. There were a few lunatics, as they referred to at the time, that were looked into by police. A 23-year-old man called Aaron Davis Cohen, who was found wandering the streets, and he was charged with being a lunatic wandering at large, an actual charge you could get in Victorian times. Cohen was found to be incredibly violent and threatened other inmates, eventually having to be transferred to an asylum. However, this was in 1888, and the torso killings continued into the next year. Strangely though, the Ripper killings did seem to stop. Then there was Thomas Hayne Cutbush, who was eventually detained under similar reasoning. He was found to have depression and would wander the streets alone late at night. He actually escaped the asylum he was trapped in and immediately assaulted two women. After being recaptured, he would be sent to Broadmoor, where he would eventually die. Like, these were the types of suspects that the police were looking into at this time. All forms of mental illness were treated the same, like simple depression was akin to being a deranged serial killer. Of course, they were never going to find the actual killer because they were just looking in the wrong place, looking in the wrong direction. This killer was methodical, he was planned, he likely wouldn't have seemed outwardly mentally ill. The police did ask the public to be on the lookout for a man wandering the streets covered in blood, but no one ever reported seeing such a thing. And of course, there were other cases in London around this time that could have been linked to the torso murderer, but they were not canonically part of the case files. There was a case called the Battersea Mystery from a few years before, which consisted of two unsolved murders. So in September 1872, the left quarter of a woman's trunk was discovered near Battersea, and at the same time, other body parts were found in other local areas, until pretty much the entire body was found and pieced together. Very similar to the later murders, the cuts on the limbs here were very neat, they hadn't really been hacked at. But despite a £200 reward being offered and a pardon being offered to any accomplices of the actual murderer, this case has always remained unsolved. People were invited to come and view this body, but no one recognised the woman. And then in June 1874, another dismembered body was found in the Thames at Putney, again the case remaining unsolved. In each case, there were plenty of avenues explored as to potential identities and asylum escapees were looked at for the murderer, but nothing was ever confirmed. I mean, looking from the outside here, it certainly seems to be that these two cases were incredibly similar to the Thames Torso murders from 13 to 14 years earlier. They're almost too similar to discount, and I couldn't find any confirmation as to why they're not deemed part of the canonical murders. I always say it, but here lies the issue with historical cases. It can really be difficult to delve more into the minute details because the information simply isn't there. Perhaps it's deemed that there was too much of a gap between these murders and the 1887 ones, perhaps it's thought that the second set was simply a copycat, or it could be that the killer was just going through cycles, bursts of murders and then pausing. But after the 74 murders, there'd be a gap of 10 whole years before he potentially struck again. In October 1884, there was something called the Tottenham Court Road Mystery, in which body parts were found in a newspaper parcel in a dustbin belonging to a local family. Meanwhile, a constable was on his beat nearby when he found what is described as a quantity of human flesh just outside one of the houses. Upon further investigation, they also found the lower parts of the body as well. Overall, feet, a thigh, a portion of the torso, an arm, and a head were all found, meaning that the medical examiner was able to deduce something interesting about this victim. Whilst it was assumed that all other victims we've mentioned in this video were lower class, it was believed that this woman here was a gentlewoman, higher class. She cared for herself. Her nails were well manicured, her hands were soft, her face was smooth with healthy hair. Whilst it was common for the poorer people in this society to slip through the cracks undetected, it was considered very strange for somebody of a clearly higher class to go missing and nobody notice. Who was this woman? Sources would also say that this woman did have a tattoo of a rose on her arm, which in this time was incredibly scandalous. Tattoos were something reserved for the lower classes, at least in England. The weird juxtaposition here could suggest that perhaps the woman wasn't from the UK. Or maybe she's a woman who went through a rebellion and been kicked out of her home. Could the medical examiner have been wrong entirely? Was she of the lower classes? All possible options. And to add another layer to this mystery, just a month earlier, a number of human bones were found at nearby Mornington Crescent that the medical examiner ultimately said had been discarded after being used for anatomical purposes, but they could have been linked. Were there two murders here? Were the bones from this same woman? Investigators trying to determine like what the case was here, whether these cases were linked, did slow down information being released publicly, so any witnesses might have gotten lost in that time. There are all the main cases possibly attributed to this serial killer, but there were a few others mentioned as well. In the 1900s, a woman's torso was found in Salamanca Alley in Lambeth, and in November 1886, a torso was found on the steps of a church in Paris, with the incisions very similar to what investigators had seen in London. Is it possible that our killer here was well travelled? Well, we simply don't know, and that's the overall conclusion of this case. We don't know, investigators don't know, historians don't know. Was this killer the same as the Ripper? We don't know, although I don't think so. As I said at the beginning of this video, it is more than likely there were two serial killers in London at the same time. I wish I had more of a conclusion to give you as I wrap up this video, but as much as I do find looking into historical cases incredibly interesting, the fact is that these torso murders were simply not covered as thoroughly as the Ripper case. Or at least if they were, the records have been lost to history as people forgot about it. Victorian London was an incredibly brutal place to live. And actually, a lot of my maternal ancestors lived in Battersea at this time. It amazes me that they survived, and I'm still here today to tell the tale. It seems like a miracle that anybody got out of Victorian London alive. Because sadly, a lot of people simply didn't. I'm very intrigued to hear what you guys all think about this case in the comments down below. Do you think the Thames Torso Murderer and Jack the Ripper were one and the same? I don't think I do, but it's a possibility, you can't discount it. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye guys.